You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
In any event, Haider, the floor is yours, and thank you very much to both of you for being here today.
Thank you, Stephen. It's my pleasure to be here. This is my second time at the Carnegie Endowment, and I am doubly honored that Jack's here and Stephen will be moderating. I've known Jack for a while, and I look forward to getting to know Stephen better. My job here is to share some of my findings about how the security dynamics in Pakistan have changed after the floods and what to expect. I will look at the state of Pakistan, the military of Pakistan, how they are struggling to fight this unprecedented and very, very drastic development. 7 million people remain homeless. One-fifth of the country at one time was underwater. Now that the waters have receded, you basically see no man's land. Everything is destroyed. I got to travel in the north and the south, in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Sindh. And I've seen with my own eyes hundreds of villages underwater, thousands of people under the naked sky. And I'm still shocked by the lack of media coverage in the United States of this terrible flood. Much bigger than tsunami, Haiti, and a couple of others combined, and still we don't hear a lot. And what is even more shocking is, unlike Haiti and other places, this country is of strategic importance to us. It has nuclear weapons. It had a military that was finally showing some success in counterinsurgency. I was there in May and June before the floods, and then I was there in August and September after the floods. On July 31st, the Pakistani surge, which began in the spring of 2009, ended. The orders given to the troops right now are to take care of the road networks, you know, lines of operations, protect these forward operating bases, and these orders are for the 11th Corps and the Frontier Corps in the north. Approximately 30,000 troops have moved away. At the peak of the surge, there were 150,000 troops. Most of their helicopters are gone. They are not planning to go into North Waziristan anytime soon. Massive troop overstretch. This is the only institution, the Pakistani military, that can do anything in the country. There is no National Guard. The National Disaster Management Authority is small, weak, and relies on the military and the army specifically. They're doing everything, which is expected in relief efforts. But they're not only in charge of relief, but also reconstruction in the north and the south, and they've taken over governance in the north. So when people talk about a military coup, the Pakistani army is already running the north and parts of the south as we speak. I was there in Nowshera, for example, on the 32nd day after the flood hit. I asked the relief officer in charge, Lieutenant General Kashif, who's basically instructed the school of artillery inside Nowshera. Overnight had to become this relief officer, and he's coordinating all relief efforts inside Nowshera, which was hit pretty hard. This is very close to the Swat Valley. And this gentleman told me that I have not seen a single politician come down here, except, of course, the president and the prime minister that came for about a couple of hours. I went to that camp. There was basically a school building and more of a photo op. After that, I got to travel a lot and visit a lot of camps. I did see certain camps that were run by Islamist organizations. They were not LET or Al-Qaeda proper, but they certainly had Islamist leanings. They were doing a phenomenal job. For example, their camps were the only ones with female bathrooms, really good medical supplies, and in fact refused to get medical supplies from the army because they had their own network that was doing very well. As far as USAID, they were the first one on the scene, but they had no oversight of what they were doing as far as Nowshera was concerned. For example, in the first 72 hours, USAID provided 2 water filtration plants. They gave them to the Army, which was supposed to give it to the civilian administrators. The civilian administrators did not install those. And I roamed around everywhere, could not find them. So first on the scene, but could not impact that. Now, in other areas, this is not a picture of everything else. I mean, you have Angels of Mercy, Marines, helicopters coming in, saving hundreds of people every day, and a lot of people saw that. As I walked around and I talked to people of all colors and asking them, do you mind if there's an American flag on a flower bag? And nobody cared about that. This is why it's so important to reset our partnership with the Pakistanis in moments like this, because this is a time when you can really reset some of the fundamental underlining principles of and try to get rid of some of the misconceptions between the people of Pakistan and the people of the United States, and not just the government level. Unfortunately, I think we have missed that boat, or will miss that boat very soon, because the window of opportunity is very small, and strategic communication is, for all purposes, a complete failure. And these are not my words, but words of brave, patriotic Americans working in the U.S. Embassy that I will not name. So we have a real problem there, and it's not just to look good, it's a matter of United States national security, because Pakistani people color everything else, including the military. So there's troop overstretch, no Waziristan operation. If you read any of my work in the last 6 months, you would probably see that I was talking about reconstruction teams that the Frontier Corps was developing, and so the 11th Corps, the military, was developing in the Fatah and the north, and basically they were trying to, it was a holding plus policy, there is no building, but you know, trying to come up with some high impact projects and helping the people over there. All those plans are now shelved or on pause. It's very, very little going on. It is, and to qualify that, it is important to note that I think 2 years ago, nobody would have imagined the Pakistani military or Frontier Corps would be holding South Waziristan for this long, or the Swat Valley. So they're doing a good job holding, and they will continue to do that. There will be no operations for in the time, at least in the next 6 to 12 months. The National Disaster Management Authority, as I said, is also under-resourced. So this is the state, the civilian government, the Pakistani Army, Frontier Corps. Police and Rangers are barely holding on to Karachi, for example. Now comes, it's very important to look at the enemy's strategy. Al-Qaeda syndicate, Lashkar-e-Taiba, sectarian groups. I use them, this simplistic term, Al-Qaeda syndicate, just to get my points across. But it is a very, very diverse group of various organizations. Al-Qaeda has done a great job investing in groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba and company. Lashkar-e-Taiba and company, you know, others like Sip-e-Sahaba and Jaish-e-Mohammed and other groups, for about 9 years have not been touched by the Pakistani military. The only group that has really invested in its membership, recruitment, training, developing second, third generation IEDs. I got a briefing. There's an IED lab in Quetta run by School of Infantry and Tactics. I got a great briefing there looking at some of the new stuff that the Al-Qaeda syndicate was using against the army, and it's just amazing. These are modern second, third type ambushes and hiring some of the best snipers, for example, and doing a very good job with all of that. And their job, if you're a smart insurgent, is to take full advantage of the floods, and they're doing it in two ways. One, they're providing very limited but high impact relief. So they're first one on the scene, but they only come with 10 bags of rice. It makes, by the time the army comes, it comes with 100 bags, but it's always a little late, and they've made their mark. And then they're on the way. The second thing is to open multiple fronts. They finally have an opportunity, they being TTP, Pakistani Taliban, TNSNM, Al-Qaeda network, Haqqani network. They're all very, very happy because troops and resources are moving away from the pressure points that were created by the Pakistani surge. And they're trying to open multiple fronts so they could go further, and they could develop more space and have more sanctuary all over the country. While I was there, there were 7 terrorist attacks, mostly suicide attacks, and they were all over. They were in Karachi, they were in Punjab, they were in Quetta, in Balochistan. So this is very important. The other thing is Al-Qaeda strength was never in numbers. It replicates. It has the best train-the-trainer program in the world. And they've been able to not only train, but also hire some great folks from the ISI alumni network, the Pakistani Intelligence. And ISI alumni network and these groups together were trained by the best in the 1980s and really retained that knowledge and has updated, mostly using the internet. And they have the best media campaign, best strategic communication, great liaison with tribes, separatists, criminal syndicates, and like I said, second, third generation IEDs, and the list goes on. And Lashkar-e-Taiba has really been the place where all the money has gone and the attention has gone from Al-Qaeda. And they've developed this, you know, boogeyman of 300 Al-Qaeda when in actuality they've been able to expand. So that's very important. The other thing is we look at Lashkar-e-Taiba sometimes and we say India-focused, Kashmir-focused, mostly Punjabis, and mostly a group that has stayed quiet. But it's actually a group that was actually formed in 1991 in Kunar province. So they have very, very strong links in Regional Command East in Paktia Loya area. And they've basically gone to school with everybody else. You look at Jaish-e Mohammed, you look at Al-Qaeda folks in the early 90s, and they were all literally in school. They were training, being trained together. So it's very important to look at that with that historical perspective. This is not a new nexus. This is not a new partnership between AQ and these other groups. The ISI has gone through, to be fair to them, in the last 2 years, some really effective reforms. They've tried to crop. They just don't have enough resources to go after everybody that they fire. So in other words, surveillance of the ISI alumni network. And frankly, they've put some new, you know, they've put some bad guys in the list. They've added bad guys to their list of bad guys. I think Al-Qaeda was the only bad guy since 2002 to 2008. But they've added Pakistani Taliban in the last 18 months and also Tariq-e-Nafaz-e-Shariat-e-Mohammedin and some of the affiliates. They have not added Lashkar-e-Taiba and other groups, which are more, I would argue, more of a tinderbox for the Pakistanis to deal with, just waiting to erupt because they're losing control over a lot of these things. And even Lashkar-e-Taiba is not monolith. There are various groups that come along. They've come out, and they're out-radicalizing the radical leadership inside. Haqqani Network remains or a version of the Haqqani Network, let's just say a cropped version of a Haqqani network, remains Pakistan's government in a box for RC East. And there is some hope that we're able to, while we're negotiating through Kabul, able to get rid of some of the worst of the worst. But I think that it is very clear that the Haqqani network still is an important asset. And if you talk to the intelligence community in Pakistan, they will tell you, they will use the term called, we are looking for a firewall on our western border that will represent pro-Pakistan governors and district governors in RC East and Regional Command South in the Paktia Loya area. And they believe that this is a compromise from the good old days when they controlled Afghanistan. So this is a troubling factor, but I think that Washington and specifically ISAP working through Kabul is trying to work through this very, very difficult thing. Then comes, of course, our role in all of this. Like I said, USAID is doing a brilliant job in providing aid. They were the first one on the scene, so were the military assets from the United States, first one within 48, 72 hours, provided the most aid, lost the battle of strategic communication, but continue to do work. Problem, of course, is the Kerry Lugar legislation. Kerry Lugar, for all intents and purposes, was a great, great bill focused on economic development, but more importantly, it was the insurance policy for the civilian government. If you read it, it's very specific. We'll give you all this money. It's your money. It's not going to go to the Pakistani army. You get to use it, and we will shut it down if the army tries to take over. The problem is it's become a relief fund, so it's no longer an insurance policy. And while some of it will continue to go as planned, I think some of the bigger projects. The very baseline for the feasibility reports that were created don't exist anymore. Example, there's a village, three schools, two medical dispensaries, and they're going to build a girls' school through subcontracting. Well, now you go back to that town, there's nothing left. You got to start with the road, the bridge, basic governance structures. So the baseline has been destroyed. That's no longer the same country. Thousands and thousands of miles just destroyed. Out of the frying pan into the fire. That's how the people feel. United States policy still remains very inconsistent, perceived to be inconsistent, and not transparent. And that hurts. That does not protect our aid workers or our military. This whole idea of having a small signature just doesn't work at all. It's not sustainable. You have to have straight talk on both sides, where you either have a relationship that comes along every 10 to 15 years, or you have something that you can rely on, so when we're bombing Iran in 10 years, or Central Asia in 15, or having another military problem with China, at least this country is consistently there in some format. And for that, it really requires going beyond these short-term things. And that's why I think the new Congress will really have to look at the dynamics. So it is very important to look at all of these things. What makes it worse, add another layer of complexity, is the battle between the Pakistani executive and the judiciary. October 13th, I believe, is a very important date, because the Supreme Court will weigh on the president's immunity. That could really change a lot of things. And there's several options on the table. Thank God most of them are constitutional. There's no confidence war. There's another government coming in. There's pressure to change leadership inside PPP. That will continue to go on. So in conclusion, you have a military that is completely overstretched, and the only institution that works, and frankly the only one that can actually do things. It has a lot of limitations, but the only one, again, relative to other institutions. They've done a brilliant job distancing themselves. I remember Pakistani People's Party politicians coming out and saying, hey, this is the Pakistani military. Of course, it works under the government. So when you look at these helicopters and look at these guys, when you're waving at them, we told them to do this. The Army has done a great job. No, do not mix me with that. So you have a 80% approval rating for the Army, 10% approval rating for the civilian government on this. They're losing a lot in not just strategic communication. They won't be able to do it. They just don't have the capacity. Even if we were to completely forget about the incompetence of the civilian government and the corruption charges, they just can't do it. They just don't have the resources. And second, they don't have a civil-military comprehensive strategy. In other words, you have a military guy in a helicopter, a politician goes with him. You have a military guy who's the only one who goes in the helicopter. He gives the press conference. He's giving out candy to the children. He has the photo ops. And I drove around with the Pakistani military, and the way people were waving. It was very different 2 years ago when the military had a 10% approval rating. So all other institutions, including the National Disaster Management Authority, are overstretched, and they rely on the military. The civilian government, again, is facing a lot of problems, and I just summarized them just now. And all of this is becoming very complex at a time when we have the Afghanistan review in, 2 months? And so we cannot expect the Pakistanis to even do the job which we weren't 100% satisfied with, which was what was happening in June. In other words, the Pakistani military had made some difficult choices. I visited all their training institutions. I've looked at their doctrine. I've looked at their case studies. I've looked at their lessons learned mechanisms. And I matched that with where they were between 2002 and 2008, and they've come a long, long way. But right now, all of those gains were easily reversible and fragile to begin with, some of them are being reversed. And what worries me is that there's always a group of people when you have institutional change, for example, in the Pakistani military and the ISI, that want to hold on to the status, the old status quo, which is that they will be more likely to cut another bad peace deal with the insurgents in Fatah, which would really turn things to the worst inside Afghanistan. So these are some of the things that I am very concerned about. What gives me hope in the end is basically the Pakistani civil society and some of the young people and students that came out and started working to give relief. And I'm not even satisfied with the Pakistani media. The last 2 weeks, all they've done is complain about the Pakistani president. And they have stopped following the floods. The Pakistani media has in the last 2 weeks. And so they can't expect a lot from the American public or even the American administration in that kind of scenario. So what gives me hope then is that I hope that the Pakistani military had retained its lessons learned from counterinsurgency. Their capabilities have gone up. They have a better presence in many of these areas. And frankly, they've been able to hold the Swat Valley and South Waziristan, which is unprecedented. So that gives me hope. And, I look forward to Jack's comments and the Q&A.
Well, thank you, Haider. Thank you, Stephen. And thank you all for coming today. My name is Jack Gill. It's very nice to see some familiar faces and happy to meet new folks. I am a government employee, so I have to issue the disclaimer that my remarks are mine and mine alone. I don't represent the United States government in any way, neither my center, the Near East South Asia Center, National Defense University, or any other branch of the government. But let me offer a few thoughts on Haider's very thorough presentation. It hardly needs a lot of comment, but I have the privilege of being here today, so I'll offer a few thoughts nonetheless. Let me highlight a couple of points. In the first instance, I think it's useful to remind ourselves that even prior to this enormous catastrophe, that Pakistan was a nation burdened by all sorts of enormous challenges, economic, societal, governance, and terrorism being the most prominent, and the sort of thing that you would see splashed across the news headlines. So the disaster has undermined everything that might have been favorable and the sort of hints of moving in the right direction, in, at least in some areas that Haider has talked about. In the second place, this is a kind of disaster that would overwhelm any country, not just Pakistan, but any place. Look at the challenges the United States faced in dealing with Katrina and multiply that many times and you end up with where the misfortunes that Pakistan's trying to contend with today. But with that as a kind of a context, there are a number of things that are quite disturbing as we look at this and look at it not just today, but as we move into the future. In the first place, the economic impact, not only the immediate economic impact on people whose livelihoods have been destroyed, whose homes have been destroyed, families dispersed, but into the future and the difficulty of reestablishing the agriculture if the situation does not allow movement rapidly enough, as well as industry for many years to come. And as Haider has pointed out, in some cases, absolutely complete rebuilding from the ground up will be required. Secondly, Haider highlighted, and I think correctly so, the diversion or disruption of security forces. Of course, not only have they been diverted from whatever tasks they were proceeding on in dealing with militants and terrorists before, but their own facilities have been damaged. And these militants now who have ravaged Pakistan for the past several years have a gap into which they can move, as, again, Haider has highlighted very thoroughly. There's also the challenge of transferring, as moving out of a relief situation into a reconstruction, rebuilding, and reestablishment of governance situation, the difficulty of transferring from the military role into a civil government role. That's been problematic, I think one can say, fairly in Sawat, in the wake of the Pakistan Army's operations there, and it will be equally difficult, if not more so, given the scale in the wake of these floods. Third, the security impact over the medium to long term in a number of arenas gives us some cause to be concerned, as the flooding has exacerbated a number of existing fractures or cleavages within Pakistan. The most obvious of these, Haider has talked about, between the army and the civilian government, and the severe damage that's been done to the civilian government standing. He's talked about that in great detail. But it's also worth thinking about the frictions between the provinces in Pakistan, as well as between social classes, especially between large landholders and tenants, such as the stories. And whether those stories are true or not, you know, I don't know, but they've certainly gained a great deal of currency and at least appear to have some footing in people's minds, that some landowners intentionally breached levies to preserve their own lands and allowed other people's lands or other provinces' lands to be flooded. And whether that, again, whether that's true or not, that that creates a tension that cannot be ignored. Fourth, I think there's another contextual piece that's useful to keep in mind, and that's that the floods occurred at the point where much of the population was already jittery and uncertain and concerned about the future and not very secure in their own daily lives, whether they were attending religious services or whether they were going to the market or just going about their daily existence, sending their kids to school. And now with this devastation and the perception of an inadequate response, in the words of a recent Pakistani think tank report, quote, the anger in Pakistan was palpable and obvious, unquote. Now, the question then becomes, okay, how does that anger resolve itself or how is that then expressed? None of this bodes especially well for the future, but as we look into the longer term, I think there are a couple of other points that are useful to keep in mind. And Heider's talked about something that's troubling, particularly from the American angle, that the U.S. assistance has received so little visibility, despite being fairly rapid, given the circumstances, and more extensive than any other country by itself. This poses not only a challenge in the immediate term, but also, I think, hampers our ability to strengthen or expand the U.S.-Pakistan partnership into the future. Related to this is the government of Pakistan's own challenge in coping with the surfeit of this poisonous conspiracy theories that any kind of a situation like this tends to generate. Blaming the United States or India for the flooding, sort of extreme examples. Again, not that the government is doing so by no means, but that these stories begin to circulate in the press, and the government now then finds itself in a position of having to try to defang or rebut or otherwise denature this sort of corrosive conspiracy theorizing. So it not only impedes, of course, rational analysis for immediate remedies and measures that might be taken to mitigate future disasters, but has a negative effect, a poisonous effect on Pakistan's international environment, in my view. International donor fatigue is an additional concern. I mean, if you listen to a lot of the reporting in the early days and talking to UN officials and other NGO members, the nature of this catastrophe, the way at which it developed, unlike the earthquakes in 2005 or the tragedy in Haiti, made it more difficult for the donor community to react in the way that one might have hoped for. And now the extent of the devastation and the extent of the human tragedy will make this even more challenging. It's going to take many years to recover, so how do we as a planet, how does Pakistan as a nation retain the interest and the focus? As Heider points out, even the Pakistani press in recent weeks has turned away from the catastrophe. You can still see reporting in the BBC on a weekly basis, but in many other places it's dropped off the front pages. The international community, of course, can only do so much, but it's certainly deeply in the interest of the world and above all of Pakistan itself that the flooded areas not become a breeding ground or a source of radicalism and violence. In the longer future, of course, as we look beyond even a recovery phase, problems of climate change, deforestation, and long-term neglect of a variety of preventive measures means that these kind of disasters have to be something that are considered serious possibilities for the future as well. And that means trying to think now about some expensive and often politically very difficult steps to mitigate future repetitions of this catastrophe or things of this nature. And again, if you translate that to an American context, think of the challenges the U.S. faces in trying to create either changes in governance or in society or in urban planning in areas of the U.S. Gulf Coast that were afflicted by Hurricane Katrina. Very challenging to do, a lot of invested interest by political groups or by local citizens, and so trying to make those changes for the long term are very, very challenging. One can hope, as if I can paraphrase Prime Minister Gilani, that the Pakistan government and its friends can try and translate this tragedy into an opportunity, but the picture at present is not very encouraging. I hope that the more hopeful points that Heider's made indeed prove true, but there's a long way to go and very many difficult challenges in the in the way to try and achieve what needs to be achieved to recover from this disaster. So I'll thank you for your attention and return the microphone to our chair.
And I will quickly turn, do we have microphones around? No, people just speak up. Then I will very quickly turn this to all of you for any questions that you might have. Ask only that you identify yourself and the institution that you are with. And with that, we'd like to open the floor. Yes, sir.
I'm Martin Benson, a Swedish consultant. I have a question regarding if you could say anything about the situation, especially the security situation, for international relief workers in the area.
Okay. It depends on where you go. I think it's directly related to the absorptive capacity of the area you focus on. The north has done a much better job, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, Swat Valley, Nowshera, precisely because of the relative success of counterinsurgency operations. There was a population resettlement program, otherwise known as the IDP problem, for example. So the international community, the Pakistani Army, USAID, International Red Cross, worked really hard to set up camps, and they were able to get back, I think about 2.2 million people got out of SWAT during the operations, and I think within 5 months, about close to 2 million were rehabilitated, quote-unquote. So there were camps, there was a process in place, and if you threw money at it, you knew where it's going to go. And if you focus on that area, you're also more secure because that's where the troops are and they have more experience. In the south is really the Wild Wild West, where the absorptive capacity is very, very little, and they haven't had anything of this nature. There were no Sindhi IDPs in the last 9 years of this war. So it depends on where you're going. And then, frankly, what your local, who your local partners are. And then I think National Disaster Management Authority is a great place to start that conversation if you represent an NGO that wants to work and in what sector. I think then, and then again, you'll end up with the military taking you to places. Just little things like, I think I was at the Canadian NGO World Vision food distribution, which was very interesting because they had a little photo op going on as people were saying, we want food now, and they went on for about half an hour. And to some degree, I can understand because they need to know that the food got to the people. So the video was actually evidence. But the Army was the one that put everybody in a file. And they had a system so that people who didn't have NADRA ID cards, national ID cards, there's no biometric stuff, that there was, they were minimizing replication and other things. So you still have to work with the military. So again, north and south, big difference, and then pick your spot and then go through NDMA.
My name is Adam Ashrani, Cal Ashrani. I am from Sindh, Pakistan originally. Okay. I just wanted to comment and then ask a question. One of my
brief comment and then a question.
One of my comment is that we had a very comprehensive briefing on Hill on 27 September, where organized by Sindhi American Political Action Committee, and actually it was organized by Congressman Sherman, Brad Sherman from California, and there were a lot of details about the losses in different provinces and some of the recommendation as to what U.S. government has been doing. I just wanted to comment on this gentleman's question. I don't know why Mr. Malik is saying that the South is the West, Wild West. Sindh is a very Sufi province, people are peaceful, you never find a terrorist, and anywhere, you go there, you're safe, you'll be safe. Anywhere, if you have any problem, I'll give you my address. The excellence team. And this is the place where you go serve, these are the people who really are tolerant. My other comment is, which again,
and did you have a question, perhaps?
Yeah, I just one comment that Mr. Haider didn't mention. There was a mention, you mentioned about landowners really breaching the land. But the biggest story in Sindh, which is being, of course, we'll never hear in Pakistani, is that the breaches occurred, especially Sakhar area, the Nagran area, was because they wanted to save Vanuatu base. There's a big an army base, and that had to be saved from the flood. So the breaches happened, and the water was put on the other side. Unfortunately, the stories of poor people don't get, and non-infidel people don't get hearing. All the scholars go on there. My other, well, the real question is, he commented that the U.S. lost the opportunity. What should U.S. have done? You said we lost the opportunity. What was the thing we should have done right away that we would have really taken based on the opportunity?
Okay. Everybody's awake now. When I talked about Wild Wild West, I was not talking about, and I would never ever do that, about the culture of the Sindhis. Yeah. I was talking about what I saw with my own eyes. I don't know when the last time you were standing on the embankment that saved Thatta. That's where I stood, and I saw hundreds of villages submerged in water. I was talking about the destruction of the floods had created the Wild Wild West, not that the people were militant, okay? So I was just talking about absorptive capacity and what I saw with my own eyes, and I brought it back here. Very few people have done that. The second point, you talked about the landlords. I completely agree with you. I had to leave something for Jack. And the third, the question, which is very important, I'm not a strategic community communication expert, okay? You have to hire people from the Wharton School who can really, really...
I'm sorry.
Save the military base where?
On the Wharton base?
No, I didn't. I did not hear. Yeah. And I think what was important then was to really have a robust media campaign. For example, you had brilliant people at ODRP, including General Nagata, who had moved to the Ghazi airbase. And they were coordinating a lot of these marine helicopters that were literally saving hundreds of people every day. They weren't able to take that story and show it to the rest of the country. Then these same helicopters and same folks moved to Sindh. They weren't able to show it on the vernacular press and the Pakistani media. When they did, they failed because nobody understood. So that's what that should have done right away. And when I say that they've lost the boat, doesn't mean that they've completely lost the boat. I mean, there's still opportunity to change all of this, and there's a lot of good work that the USAID folks are doing. We just need to make it visible. Obviously, you have to be sensitive. You can't make it visible the first couple of days because you're trying to help and then have a photo op at the same time. But people need to know. I remember sitting in Islamabad watching TV at night, and the Saudi sent one C-130, and Geo showed that for 5 hours straight. And they had like literally a 30-second clip from General Nagata talking about hundreds of flights coming in, you know, in a span of time. So this is what I mean. This is a small example, but this itself is a long debate, and we can discuss it afterward.
Ali Jamani from Georgetown University. Can you help explain the TTP's logic in attacking civilian targets in terms of how much, you know, alienation it's causing among the mainstream population? I'm not suggesting that they, you know, enjoy any widespread sympathies to begin with. But we saw attacks, particularly bloody week in the beginning of September that you referenced, attacks on Shia, attacks on shrines, etc. We saw attacks today in Karachi. Just that.
Okay. It's very hard to put them in a nice group. You know, there's so much of replication and consultants coming from LET and Jashi Muhammad, then some of them are sectarian groups. So, for example, I'm assuming Lashkar Jhangni was in charge of the attacks against the Shias or the Ahmadis or the Sufis. But there seems to be this general pattern that I agree with, which is to open multiple fronts. And the trade-off is, yes, we're going to lose some public support, but then these troops that are putting this pressure on us would eventually start moving, and that's what we need. So what they look for in the perfect world, they look for another Mumbai. More realistically, they look at opening up another front in Karachi. I got extensive briefings from the intelligence community that talked about folks that they had captured who then gave intelligence about a plan to attack the Karachi airport to disrupt the NATO supplies, as you saw. So it's very strategic in that sense. But local partners, at the same time, have their own goals. And unfortunately, when they did attack Ahmadis and Shias and Sufis, they weren't able to garner the kind of anti-Taliban sentiment that we would expect, because unfortunately, killing Sunnis and Shias and Ahmadis or even Sufis just didn't get the kind of reaction from the Pakistani people. So they lost less and they gained more by actually opening up. So if you look at the Rangers and the police force in Karachi, completely overwhelmed, it's only a matter of days that they're going to call the military to step in if the rate of violence keeps increasing. Other places too. So I think that's the time, because they were under a lot of pressure. They lost a lot of sanctuary. They lost most of northern Fatah. They lost South Waziristan. They lost entire Swat Valley, Shangla, Bnei, Deer, in the last 18 months before the floods. They want to gain back, and they certainly want to. So I think the trade-off works for them, and this is there's a net gain, is as I understand it, knowing that this is a very simplistic way, because all these groups also have their own specific regional sectarian goals.
I think I would highlight the importance of what Haider mentioned at the very end, that each of these outfits and sometimes sub-factions within them require a nuanced approach. But in a general sort of sense, it's important to stress what he mentioned regarding the targeting of minorities, that's a fair, in many cases, would be considered fairly safe target, and yet you also create mayhem, you bring the government into question, and you cause... you can hope to cause potentially a government overreaction that redounds to your benefit as the militant, or a reaction by counter-militant groups or radical groups within the minority elements. And so you thereby create disturbance and anarchy and a sense of poor governance that for many militant organizations they consider beneficial as for their sort of immediate purposes for a longer-term goal.
Clay Ramsey, program on international policy attitudes. I'd like to go back to the question of why you see a decline in media coverage of the floods, and to try to think through possible causes and conditions for that. It occurs to me that it may be just very logistically difficult to do audiovisual. To get in with a crew and have enough of a power source, given the resources that the Pakistani media has got. And if that's the case, that could be looked on as a need that NGOs could help to fill, for instance. Another possible reason is that if the Pakistani media is overly focused on the operations of the government in Islamabad, if the government is not visibly planning for the future, you know, if it doesn't set up committees of experts that are developing plans for how they're going to get Pakistan out of this, then that creates an absence of events for them to cover. I'm just speculating, but sometimes something like an absence of media coverage is a soluble problem.
I think the number one problem is that the American media doesn't realize that the probability of the next 9/11 coming from Pakistan is much higher now than it was a year ago. And it will continue to be like this for a while. That's the bottom line. So you want fear-mongering, here it is. And what they do, the media, has to just connect the story of the floods to national security and then just come up with a really nice chart of troops, number of troops, and where they are and what they're doing, and the capabilities of the Pakistani government. And then you can add nuances about reconciliation with the Taliban and other things in Pakistan's geopolitical stance. They have not successfully made that connection. If they did that, you would see everybody there. I think in the beginning, as far as for people who actually have hearts, the humanitarian factor is also very important. But it's a subset of the national security part. Okay, that's where our investment is. That's where the weapons have gone, and that's frankly the only partner. Otherwise, we have to have about 400,000 troops and do a ground invasion, capture the nuclear weapons, and do the job ourselves. And so you have to have a straight talk about exactly why Pakistan is important, and unfortunately, it's the negatives that will bring the media there. The humanitarian part is a very important aspect, and I think, again, I was just shocked. I mean, you didn't see Anderson Cooper from CNN camping out there like he did in Haiti. I think Sanjay Gupta came for like a couple of days. There's a great gentleman there, Raza something at CNN. He does it. But the the print media did a great job. New York Times, I think to some degree Washington Post. I know David Ignatius is there as we speak. So they're doing a good job, but you got to get the visuals out there. And there's these amazing stories that we just haven't heard about, even from relief actors. I met a gentleman in Nowshera, and he was a non-commissioned officer. He was given orders to evacuate hundreds of people in a matter of like 16 hours. And his own family was stranded, did not mention it at all. In the end, said, when the day was over, he's like, by the way, my family's stranded out there. My mother-in-law with a wheelchair is on top of this roof. I have to go on a boat and get them. And he got all of them back. But he was so committed to saving other people. This is just an example. And these are the kind of stories, obviously, military-focused, but then there are amazing number of stories from NGOs and private citizens across the board that came out and really, I mean, the sense of community in Sindh and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa in Punjab is amazing, because those are the people that set up community kitchens and things like that. And so you've got both angles, and I think, and if you want to talk more, you've got, you know, Aisha Chaudhry here from The Observer, who's done a lot of work. You have Rabia here, who's associate at ISPU, and they really look at this, you know, as that's their focus. But I look at it as a subset of security.
Been following, thank you, South Asia for a long time. And I wanted to ask Haider Malik to clarify something. I understood, and you could see the thrust of your argument, that gaps in the government's response, civilian and military, to the floods gave various militant groups an opportunity to show their stuff and perhaps do some recruiting. But what I am not sure I understand, and maybe I misunderstood what you said, is how that possible increase in support around the edges for these groups increases the threat that a next attack on the U.S. will come from Pakistan. I wasn't sure if that was the causal link that you were making. How is that greater than it would have been without the floods? It seems to me threat projection is quite different from public support and disruption of government control.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Polly. Polly's known me for a long time when I first came here as a graduate student, and I really respect. So the argument I was making was of the entire syndicate, and I wasn't just talking short term, but in long term, a smart insurgent would like to open multiple funds and create more space. Now, that space doesn't mean tomorrow you have 100 recruits, but you create an environment where you can eventually have an increase in the recruitment rate. The area that they've always had, and I agree with you, which actually becomes worse, which is North Waziristan. So, yes, you have a drone campaign, and it's difficult to do the kind of training that you can do in southern Punjab, but they have a very close link with insurgents in southern Punjab. This area was supposed to be part of the target list for the Pakistani military. When I was in June and I was talking to the 11th Corps commander, he was very confident about going into North Waziristan. Selectively, obviously, Pakistani military has a special place for the Haqqani network, but they were at least going to make an attempt. They're not going to make that attempt. And then what happens is with these troops are literally holding Swat and South Waziristan, literally. I mean, if you remove them, the bad guys come in right away. And there's no long-term strategy there. For example, there is no levies or Khasadars who are ready to take over, or even Frontier Corps, even though Frontier Corps has come a long way. So it's very important to look at. So the reason why the probability goes up is that there is no North Waziristan operation. And in the medium to long term, in about a year, if the situation is sustained, then you see more spaces where these things can happen. You already see how smart Al-Qaeda is with, you know, trying to recruit Europeans and other people. I think about 35 countries that don't need a visa to the United States, citizens of those countries still being trained and being killed. The Germans is a good example. So they're smart. They're trying to take full advantage. They're looking short-term, medium-term, and long-term. And the way I've looked at Al-Qaeda, their lessons learned, their metrics. I mean, there's. I just want to plug in my report, which comes out next week, and you'll see really nice tables of stuff that I've picked up in the last couple of years from them. So extremely smart organization, a conglomerate that has done this amazing work. So they look at this in a very strategic way, and they do these cost-benefit analyses of popular support versus getting as many army folks out of their area so they can expand operations. So this is why I said that. So it's not the probability increases because they get more space and that Pakistanis don't go into North Waziristan. Now.
I'm Khalid from visiting fellow at the Stimson Center. I would like to clarify one thing. As you mentioned that Pakistan Army is not moving into the North Waziristan. The presence of Pakistan Army of very large forces already there in the North Waziristan. So it's not a free run for the any segment of the Taliban to run the sanctuaries there. The only problem is that the offensive is not being launched, and that is being tied off because Pakistan Army had a successful operation in South Waziristan, then in Khurram Agency, then in the Sawat, and all the frontier battle. So that is the reason. So the presence of the army is there. One of your term which you used, that was in your talk, that was Al-Qaeda syndicate. And then you mentioned Tehreek-e-Taliban, Lashkar-e-Tayyab, etc., etc. By implication, it means that all these, by implication, it means that the syndicates have, all the segment of the syndicates have the agreement. Pakistan Army is fighting for the last 6 years against the Tehreek-e-Taliban. It has lost more than 2,700 soldiers. The injuries are beside that. It is more than what we suffered in 65 and 1971 war with India. So still you think that Pakistan Army would be allowing any other segment of Al-Qaeda which has the alliance with that not going against them? I couldn't understand that.
When I talked about the syndicate, it's a symbiotic, very complex relationship. The table I draw is like the imports from and export to Al-Qaeda. Many of these relationships between these groups remain clandestine. Lashkar-e-Jangmi is never going to openly come and say, you know, we talk to the number three of Al-Qaeda all the time, or we get their trainers, or we try to. But all these expertise are out there. Now, you let me throw in another group, Balochistan Liberation Front, for example. And if you look at the BLA, they don't get along with TTP at all. But if you look at some of the things, again, I traveled in Quetta and met many of the folks who have been fighting in the Baloch insurgency between 2003 and 2006. Of how many of the expertise or the things that they will look at, IEDs and others, were being transferred. So you don't necessarily have to have the exact same goal. Many of them have local goals, and then some regional, and others have international ambition. TTP, for example, has evolved from being a local group to now coming out with these statements that we want to bomb New York City. Whether they can or not, highly suspect. If anything, I think other groups have a better chance of doing that. That's what I meant with the symbiotic relationship. And they cut it off. It's based on opportunity, based on need, and what the other person can do. Al-Qaeda needed these groups to stay alive in those areas. They don't have direct tribal liaisons. They don't have the kind of protection that was provided. That doesn't mean I'm Al-Qaeda if I'm providing protection. But at the same time, there is a connection. That's what I meant. So it's not, I wish it was that simple, because then we would win tomorrow. We'd know exactly where they are, and everybody's in one nice pool, and we go on. I completely agree with you. The report outside on the Pakistani surge tracks down 2 years of research looking at how the Pakistani military changed its strategy, gone to all the training institutions, talked to people from the captain level all the way to the three-star. And so I followed it very carefully, and I've been always optimistic about where they came from the operations in between 2002 and 2008. But the floods is a game changer. We have to admit it. And we have to admit that an army that lost 3,000 and a country that lost more people than any country, and an army that in the coalition that lost more men than in any other country, then had to also do relief efforts because nobody else is there. And they had to provide their combat helicopters at times. And you know this. So how can you have an offensive in that? So I agree with you in that context. And so I wanted to clarify about the syndicate. It's always complex. I can draw a network right now, and tomorrow morning it will be irrelevant, because that's how dynamic these groups are. Thank you.
Question in the back. Yes. Nick Brown, University of Chicago. I wanted to ask, as far as Mr. Mulick, you said there would be sort of a multiple front war that Al-Qaeda is kind of engaging with the military. I was wondering what you think that the military and the civilian government, as far as regionally, where should they focus their efforts after the initial crisis phase is over? And more importantly, where do you think that they will focus them? I mean, as Americans, obviously, we'd like to say the tribal regions, but I would be surprised if they're not worried about possibly some sort of India trying to use this as some sort of means of bringing up the issue in Kashmir again. So if you could just talk a little bit about that.
The Pakistani army is an India-centric military, okay? It's predominantly conventional force. It has gone through a very, very difficult process of developing fairly good irregular warfare capabilities over time. They've fought counterinsurgency since 1947, several times in Balochistan, Bangladesh, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa several times. So it's not like they didn't have the experience. They just came to the wrong conclusions. They just don't match up with the best practices that we know of, but they do things differently, and they have their own hybrid. For example, when the pressure built up in the Pakistani military in early in the spring of 2008, when General Kiani set up the secret commission that called up all his main generals, and the agenda was, why are we losing the war and how can we win? And at that time, the end goal was not necessarily population security, but it was also actually the coherence of the military and the morale level. There was a 10% morale level. Nobody wanted to fight this war. You're killing a fellow Muslim, fellow Pakistani, you come home, nobody sings songs about you. And the media was against the military. So it is India-centric. We don't have a choice. If we look at Pakistani military and say, hey, why don't you focus on the tribal areas and let your National Guard or your military or your civilian government do the rest? No. Military has to do everything. So that's a core number of people, okay? So whether it's a war with Al-Qaeda or multiple fronts, relief, and at times even governance, let's be very honest about it, they're the ones that are spread out. So if you look at them and say, hey, can you bring, you know, where do we move troops from, is the answer. And so it's a real number of troop strength, capabilities, and the kind of burden that the military is facing after the floods. I mean, it's completely overwhelmed. The good old days of just 2 months ago when General Tariq Khan and I were sitting, when he was so passionate about reconstruction teams that he was setting up, I looked at how Frontier Corps had come a long way. They had cleared areas. They had a sophisticated plan for population resettlement for the Massoud tribe. I mean, those were very optimistic times. That's not the situation today. They are completely overwhelmed. And so the question now is, when we demand something, we have to know the new parameters and the new baseline, which is a very different country.
Corey Sobel from the Stimson Center as well. I'm wondering if you've noticed any significant changes in the rhetoric about the Indus Waters Treaty or about how environmental issues should be approached, deforestation, or do you, or a sort of subset of that, do you see their space being opened up in the future now for sort of environmental rhetoric to be more robust and addressed in a substantive way?
Yeah, your question is very important. In fact, it brings up to something that I didn't even mention because I didn't want to completely make you guys suicidal. Is that the floods come every year, okay? And they will come next year. And we haven't even talked about that. And so I think it's very important. I think the civilian government, my own understanding is that tried to play the India card with the whole Indus Waters. It just didn't hold. I mean, at that time, you know, saying that somehow they'd open up a couple of dams or some let go of some water, it just didn't work. I mean, when you have your own feudal lords doing these things and others, folks that are involved in diverting water, with very poor approval rating for the federal or the provincial government. I mean, these things really don't stick. But, you know, I believe that they tried it. I don't think that that there's any truth to that. But the Indus Water Treaty, generally speaking, is a hot topic. Again, in the good old days before the floods, there was real talk about, you know, the argument from the Pakistanis was, well, we need to basically re-examine it. And India is suspect of building more dams than it was supposed to, and then water shortages and things of that nature. So you go from like drought to like massive floods. I don't think they're looking at that right now. It's basically survival for the government, survival for a lot of people. But these two things, that floods will come next year and that the Indus Water Treaty is a sticking issue, will eventually come back.
But you raise a good point. That's what I was, one of the things I was trying to get to was this, these long-term and oftentimes very difficult measures to implement in how do you provide local people with alternatives to cutting down all the trees in the neighborhood? How do you try to prepare for and get a government system that's strong enough to implement the kind of flood control measures and to update the systems that date back to the British colonial times, desilting waterways, and all those kind of challenges. I mean, if you look at the time of President Musharraf and the difficulty of attempting to build a dam that caused great controversy because one province felt it would be disadvantaged, the other appeared to be in favor of a different province. So these kind of challenges are very hard politically to cope with, and yet this flooding highlights the challenge and the devastation that can be caused if you don't address those things. And those are all within the near term, but will have longer term consequences. So that's going to be very, very difficult, I think. And Hyder highlights the some of the detail level of that, but it's very challenging.
I'm Jennifer Atkin with the Carnegie Endowment. I was curious as to whether you're familiar with the SARC response to the floods and if they were involved at all in any disaster management or food relief.
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't know that SARC as an entity, I think individual countries have done, but I don't know that SARC, it's possible. I just don't know. I should highlight, by the way, that in terms of these sort of mitigatory actions that one can take, that Bangladesh gets some considerable credit for because of the challenges it faces every year, practically every year, with cyclones on a recurring basis, that they've taken some steps that have helped to mitigate the impact on people at the village level when the cyclones strike. So there might be, I'm not familiar with all the details of those, but there might be steps there that would be of benefit to Pakistan to look at to see what might apply, what might not apply in Pakistan's case as well.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank both of us.
I'd like to thank both of our speakers for being here today and for taking everybody's questions. Very clearly, this is a complicated problem that's going to be with us for a while. I think the fact that the Kerry Lugar legislation, as you said, has become relief aid rather than what it was intended is problematic. Clearly, civil-military relations and the future there is something that we're all worried about. The degree, I mean, I think we're all also aware, Hyder, as you pointed out, the bandwidth problems that existed even before the floods for the military have become far worse, and Jack, the economic and social problems that existed and that continue to exist. Thank you both for shedding as much light as is possible on all of these different issues, and thank you all for coming today.
Thank you.